Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump says the Central Intelligence Agency conclusion that Russia interfered in last month's presidential election to boost his chances of winning was ridiculous, calling it just another excuse by Democrats for his upset of former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Appearing on Fox News Sunday, Trump was asked why he doesn't want daily intelligence briefings.
First of all, these are very good people that are giving me the briefings. And I say, if something should change from this point, immediately call me. I'm available on 1 minute's notice. I don't have to be told, you know, I'm like a smart person. I don't have to be told the same thing and the same words every single day for the next 8 years. Could be 8 years, but 8 years. I don't need that.
Trump told Fox News that he does not oppose President Barack Obama's order to review cyber attacks the CIA concluded came from Russia during the lengthy presidential campaign. The CIA said it had high confidence that Russia sought to help Trump win. An explosion at Cairo's Coptic Orthodox Cathedral complex Sunday has killed at least 25 people and wounded nearly 50 others. Egypt's official news agency reports an assailant threw a bomb into a chapel at St. Mark's in Cairo's Abbasia district. There has been no claim of responsibility for the attack. More than 500 Coptic protesters gathered at the scene of the explosion, deriding the government and calling for the president to step down. Dozens of Muslim supporters joined the Christian protesters. This is VOA News. A Kurdish militant group has claimed responsibility for the bombings that killed at least 38 people and wounded more than 150 others in the Turkish city of Istanbul. The claim was made Sunday by the Kurdistan Freedom Falcons, or TAK, a group seen as an offshoot of the outlawed PKK. The blast rocked a huge football stadium late Saturday. Witnesses and authorities said the attacks, a car bombing and a suicide blast, targeted security officers 2 hours after a football match ended. Turkey's interior minister said 30 police officers were among those killed. This television sports show was underway when the blast occurred. Authorities say the blast targeted a bus carrying riot police from the Vodafone Arena on the shore of the Bosphorus. A Syrian monitor says Islamic State jihadists have recaptured the Syrian city of Palmyra during what has become a back-and-forth battle for control of the famed desert city. Earlier Sunday, the British-based monitor group, Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, and the Russian Defense Ministry said more than 60 Russian airstrikes had forced Islamic State fighters to pull out of the ancient central Syrian city not long after the extremists fought their way into it. The observatory said fighting continued outside the city. A massive truck bomb exploded outside Mogadishu's new seaport Sunday morning, killing at least 20 people and wounding dozens of others. The militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the blast that occurred in a parking lot near the entrance of Mogadishu's port, causing huge damage to the surrounding areas. Mogadishu residents said the blast could be heard across the city, and pictures of black smoke from the scene were circulated on social media. Mogadishu's regional administration spokesman told VOA's Somali service that most of the victims were civilians. Mogadishu's seaport is run by Al Bayrak, a Turkish company that has a 20-year agreement with the Somali government to upgrade and manage the operations of the port. Rescue workers continue to look for survivors in the debris following the collapse of a church roof in southern Nigeria, killing at least 60 people. Hundreds of people were in the Rainer's Bible Church, which was still under construction, when the roof collapsed Saturday in the city of Uyo. Media reports say at least 60 people died in the incident, but local police say the casualties could not be confirmed because rescue operations are still ongoing. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Mpoga. Peter is away.
Tragedy struck. The roof of the church auditorium, which was filled with people, collapsed, leaving many people dead and several others injured.
At least 60 people are dead in southern Nigeria after the roof of a church collapses onto worshippers.
They started with a very large area, actually more than 40,000 square kilometers that they were looking at, and they figured, okay, this area has been basically hunted out. This area has been basically hunted out, but this area has still got a lot of animals.
The DRC celebrates the opening of its first national park since the 1970s.
They are taught to drive by the same people who are breaking the laws at the moment. Even your people who get legitimate driving licenses are not prepared for road hazards.
And we conclude our series on road chaos in South Africa. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. At least 60 people in the southern Nigerian city of Uyo died Saturday when the roof of a crowded church collapsed onto worshippers. The Reyners Bible Church International was still under construction, and workers had been rushing to finish it in time for Saturday's ceremony to ordain founder Akan Wicks as a bishop.
Many worshippers were unprepared for the turn of events. Tragedy struck. The roof of the church auditorium, which was filled with people, collapsed, leaving many people dead and several others injured. Udom Emmanuel was one of the guests at the event, but he escaped unhurt. Apparently disappointed and sorrowful over the day's occurrence, the governor vents his feelings. Governor Emmanuel does not stop there, but vows to set up an inquiry into the building collapse. The governor also took time out to visit those who were injured at the Ibom Specialist Hospital, where they are receiving treatment.
Media reports say rescue workers continue to look for survivors in the debris. Meanwhile, a fuel tanker has collided with several vehicles on a Kenyan highway, killing at least 33 people and injuring scores of others in a huge ball of flames. The death toll is expected to rise. The accident happened Saturday in western central Kenya on the Nairobi-Naivasha highway, about 10 kilometers north of Naivasha. President Uhuru Kenyatta says the tanker responsible for the deaths should not have been on that particular road at that hour, and he expects the agencies responsible for enforcing traffic regulations to fully investigate this tragic breach. Officials say the accident was caused by a minivan ferrying combustible materials. It lost control before slamming into vehicles from oncoming traffic at the Karaya area on the Naivasha-Nakuru road. The Democratic Republic of Congo contains some of the largest and most diverse rainforests in the world, but in recent decades it has suffered from deforestation and poaching. On December 10th, the country celebrated the opening of its first national park since the 1970s. William Claus was at the ceremony in Kinshasa, the Congolese capital, and he reports for VOA.
The rainforest of the Congo Basin is second in size only to the Amazon and spans six African countries. More than half of that area is found in the Democratic Republic of Congo. On December 10th, the DRC celebrated the creation of Lamami National Park, the eighth of its kind in the country, but the first since 1975. The US-financed Lukuru Foundation launched the project to create the park a decade ago, and has worked alongside two provincial governments and the ICCN, a semi-governmental agency responsible for managing protected areas. Therese Hart of the Lukuru Foundation spoke to VOA about how the 9,000 square kilometres of Lamami National Park was carved out of the DRC's interior.
They started with a very large area, actually more than 40,000 square kilometers that they were looking at. And they figured, okay, this area has been basically hunted out. This area has been basically hunted out, but this area has still got a lot of animals. So it's very rich and very exciting, not only for mammals, but also for plants.
Researching a previously unknown area, they discovered the presence of various rare species endemic to the DRC, such as the okapi, the bonobo, and the Congo peacock. They also found about 600 endangered African forest elephants and a new kind of monkey. VOA asked Hart about the main threats these animals face.
Really, the only threat now in this area is hunting. So it's elephant poaching and commercial bushmeat hunting. Those are the threats. So far, we've been very fortunate in that there's no gold, there's no diamonds, there's no coltan, it's not a mineral-rich area.
In order to secure the assent of the local population for the creation of the park, five traditional ceremonies known as Tambiko were held. Large communities gathered to call upon the ancestors they share and to make collective decisions.
There's a lot of singing, a lot of dancing, parts of it we do not see, or certainly I, as a woman, am not allowed to see. There are symbols of the ancestors that are present. It's very, very interesting.
The park is completely free of human habitation, and the partners have established projects to provide alternative livelihoods for the communities on the periphery of the reserve, such as fish ponds and employment in the park. Pastor Cosmo Willingula Balongelwa, the Director General of the ICCN, is positive about the park's prospects.
Avant, la conservation était l'affaire des blancs. Le parc, c'était l'affaire de blanc.
In the past, he said, conservation has been the affair of white people. Parks have been the business of white people. But today, he claims, the Congolese man in the village has understood that the park is his heritage, and he is involved in its conservation. At one point, local politics intervened and the message of harmony was interrupted. A provincial parliamentarian from Chopo, one of the two provinces in which the park is located, complained that Maniema, the other province involved, benefits disproportionately from the new park.
La délégation de la Chopo, Kia, par courtoisie.
He said that the delegation from Chopo could not legitimize a state of affairs it finds unacceptable. He then led a walkout accompanied by the governor of the province who was sitting on the panel. The governor of Maniema apologized for the disturbance and concluded, stating that the Congolese nation is pleased to offer Lamami National Park to humanity. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
The Paris Climate Change Accords, which 172 nations signed last year, appear to be related to science and the natural world on which life depends. Humans contribute to climate change, particularly global warming caused largely by the trapping of heat in the atmosphere due to the burning of fossil fuels. The process impacts the cultural and historical treasures that make human life worth living. In this report, VOA's Adam Phillips looked at these climate trends and what is being done to help offset the harm.
A warming world means that sea levels are rising. That's because water expands when it heats up, and the vast ice sheets on Antarctica and Greenland melt and flow into the oceans. Adam Markham is Deputy Director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He says rising sea levels cause increased flooding for cities on or near the coasts where most people live, and the storm surges that result from increasingly frequent superstorms and other extreme weather events make severe floods extremely likely.
When you have a storm surge on top of a high tide, that can be maybe 3 to 5 meters higher than normal water levels. So it's really the storm surge on top of high tide that is the real danger time.
It sounds really scary.
Yeah, climate change and sea level rise, which is the main impact we sort of talk about, is really scary, and I think it's getting scarier by the day.
Over the long term, higher sea levels threaten the very existence of many of the world's cities. Over the shorter term, they can also damage or destroy important cultural and heritage sites, both in and near cities and in remote areas. Some disasters have already occurred at these sites. In the U.S., for example, Superstorm Sandy severely damaged the island where the Statue of Liberty stands in New York Harbor. It forced a years-long shutdown and required $100 million in infrastructure repair. And Markham says that Jamestown Island in Virginia, the first British colonial settlement in America, is not more than a meter above sea level.
And probably within 50 years, most of Jamestown Island will have completely disappeared.
World sea level rise is of intense concern to Mechthild Rösler, director of UNESCO's World Heritage Center in Paris. It oversees and helps protect or repair 1,031 World Heritage Sites.
Recent climate change models, which we have looked at from scientists, they have estimated that the rising sea level due to climate change could drown a fifth of all cultural World Heritage Sites during the next 100 years. So this is something which is really dramatic.
There are beautiful, unique, and deeply cherished heritage sites all over the world. One thinks of Venice, Italy, the Great Wall of China, the Sydney Opera House in Australia, and Cambodia's Angkor, to name just four of the most famous. Africa has 131 World Heritage Sites all its own, says Lisa Ackerman of the World Monuments Fund, which helps restore and preserve many of them.
Africa is a continent that would never cease to provide new wonders for travelers. One could find extraordinary places, whether it's Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela was held, off the coast of South Africa, is a place because it's an island, is obviously affected by rising sea levels. There are other places like Cape Coast in Ghana, another fortification on the water affected by rising sea levels.
Some scientists are optimistic that climate change can be slowed to manageable levels and adapted to, if not reversed. What's needed, they say, is political and popular will and education, coupled with the demand that the love for life and the planet will hold sway over ignorance and denial. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
As we come to the end of the year, UN Women and other groups are calling for an end to violence against women. They are also promoting international and national legislation to protect women and girls and support community efforts to end gender-based abuse. From Washington, VOA's William Eagle looks at some of the agency's efforts in sub-Saharan Africa.
Women's rights activists say violence comes in many forms, including intimidation, harassment, and rape as a weapon of war. One of the most common is from intimate or family relationships. Statistics tell part of the story. Simone Ellis Oluwatolunya is the Deputy Regional Director for Eastern and Southern Africa for UN Women. She says figures from the African Development Bank show that an estimated 37% of women in sub-Saharan Africa are victims of intimate partner violence. Some research shows a high level of tolerance for wife beating, and some women are among those who support it. UN Women and its partners work to convince the public that domestic violence can no longer be accepted as normal. Oluwatolunya cites a World Bank study of women's attitudes on the topic in Guinea and Mali.
The report says 75% of women report acceptance of wife beating. Socially, it's considered a normal practice. In some situations, not all, but in some situations, it is considered an honor, if you like, that your relationship is strong if you are beaten.
Results of the violence are not just physical and psychological, but also economic. Oluwatolunya says a report by the African Development Bank showed that in Tanzania, female victims of violence earned between 30 to 40% less income than those who had not suffered domestic abuse.
So you're taking productive people out of the economy, you're building on the cost of health care, of counseling, of the justice system. This all adds up.
Violence against women is not just limited to the home. In an age of democratic elections, intimidation has been used against promising women candidates in Côte d'Ivoire, Kenya, Uganda, Nigeria, and Zimbabwe.
That can be in order to discourage the women to go forward for a position, and also it has happened against voters.
In an effort to solve the problem, UN Women is working with national governments and civil society to set up hotlines for use during the election period. Women and others can call in to alert authorities and activists about areas of potential danger to women.
They're able to immediately call through and report the incident. This goes through to our situation room. And in the situation room, we have a network where support can be deployed immediately to the hotspot area. That would be if it's the police or civil society organizations, what have you.
UN Women is engaged with partners in civil society and with national governments to end gender violence in other ways as well. It works, for example, to pass national legislation and improve policies ensuring justice for women. It also works with local authorities and community leaders, as in this effort described by Oluwach Olunya.
We are working with the uniformed forces in terms of sensitizing them, giving them clear knowledge and information on what exactly is ending violence against women, what are the existing legislations within the country that will enable them to manage this situation, how it can be documented, and what other areas of support are required for the woman.
In many countries, including Ethiopia and South Africa, UN Women has established shelters where battered women can be safe and find access to medical and legal services. The UN agency also works with men and community leaders to protect women from violence and also from some harmful traditional practices. For example, thousands of young girls each year are harmed while undergoing female circumcision. Others under 18 who are forced to marry are vulnerable to problems during delivery or are at risk of developing fistula. These are tears in the reproductive tract that allow the leakage of body waste, causing pain and often social ostracism. A community leader in Ethiopia who preaches against early marriage and gender-based violence is Archbishop Abune Marcos from the East Gojem Zone Diocese. With the support of UN Women, he has trained more than 300 religious leaders to reject harmful traditional practices and prejudices, some which are justified by what he calls misinterpreted religious principles. Archbishop Marcos says he'd like to help train others in theological schools throughout the country. Education is power and the key to freedom, he says. Development activists agree and add that women's freedom is a crucial part of boosting Africa's development. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Kenya is expanding the cultivation of a new type of forage grass that could boost milk production and increase the incomes of families. The grass is nutritious and drug resistant and is already being used in several other countries in East Africa. VOA's Leonard Ruvaga reports from Siaya, Kenya.
The Oromos begin their daily routine by cutting grass for their prized cow. Both husband and wife, subsistence farmers in Siaya, about 400 kilometers from Kenya's capital, Nairobi, turned to dairy farming 2 years ago to supplement their income. In the past, their milk production was around 3 liters. On average, they earned $100 a month, barely enough for their basic needs before changing to the new fodder. However, since adopting a new variety of grass known as Brachiaria, they noticed a drastic change in milk production and their income, which increased to $200.
This grass is better because it makes us get a lot of milk from our dairy cow. Before we use it, we were getting only 3 liters. But after we started using it, we switched to 10 liters per day, 12 liters per day.
About 1,000 farmers in the area are registered at the Samalanga Dairy Cooperative, which processes the milk on their behalf. Jacob Ojal, an official at the co-op, says the plant has seen an increase in milk production. Ojal says that during the dry season, farmers who haven't adopted the new grass suffer losses.
Not all farmers have adopted the Bulgaria species. Because of the maybe shortage of the seeds around, and also the price of the seeds, how to get them. But the few farmers who have, so you find that during the dry spells, the farmers who have not adopted that one, they get it hard to, they have a problem in feeding their animals.
Plant breeders at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, SEAT, in collaboration with the International Livestock Research Institute, ILRI, began research on this particular brachiaria grass 5 years ago. Dr. Anne Nottenbert, one of the scientists on the project, says the new variety of grass is improving livelihoods of farmers.
We believe we have a good solution for African farmers in terms of providing feed for their animals that will increase their productivity, and that is also suitable to some of the more difficult areas in terms of drought. And at the same time, it will also reduce climate change, greenhouse gas emissions. So it's a real win-win for the farmers and the wider community.
Around 4,000 farmers in Kenya have adopted the new grass. Lenny Rovaga for VOA News, Siaya, Kenya.
Thanks, Reni. Now, South Africa is in the midst of a road safety crisis. The World Health Organization's Global Road Safety Report 2015 says traffic officials are failing to enforce basic laws on the country's roads. State statistics reflect that about 14,000 people are killed in car crashes annually in South Africa, but independent analysts say the yearly death toll is well above 20,000. In this final part of our series about road safety in South Africa, Darren Taylor reports on possible solutions to the predicament.
Former police detective Howard Dembowski heads the Justice Project. It's a non-profit that monitors the implementation of laws in South Africa. Dembowski says to significantly lessen road deaths, the government must stop corruption at driving license testing centres. He says many South Africans are bribing corrupt testing officials to get their driver's licences.
They are taught to drive by the same people who are breaking the laws at the moment.
This means there are millions of drivers on the roads who don't know even the most basic of traffic laws. Dembowski also calls for South Africa to scrap its K53 license test. He says it doesn't teach motorists to drive defensively.
Even your people who get legitimate driving licenses are not prepared for road hazards.
The K53 test was enacted in South Africa in 1989. The same year, the United Kingdom abandoned it, with authorities there branding it inadequate.
It does not require a person to be able to drive on a freeway. It does not require a person to be able to drive at night. We do not do any night blindness testing. We don't do any 3D perception testing.
Then, says Dembowski, South Africa needs many more traffic police officers trained to the highest international road safety standards. At the moment, there are only 200 such officers serving the whole country. Senior Johannesburg Metro Police official Superintendent Edna Mamonyane agrees that specialized police road units must be expanded. One such unit is the 54 Squad, which investigates fatal road smashes.
They will go out and deal with the reconstruction of the scene to try and help the courts to process the cases quicker and easier and take decision and right decisions for families to find closure.
Thousands of people are killed in collisions caused by minibus taxis every year. Their drivers are often poorly trained, and they drive recklessly. Dembowski says South Africa's minibus taxi industry must be better regulated, like in other African countries.
In order for you to convey persons for gain, you have to undergo a state-run defensive driving course with simulating passengers, etc., etc., before you are allowed to be given a professional driving permit. In South Africa, nothing.
He says other motorists see that the authorities don't prosecute taxi drivers for dangerous driving, and so they copy their bad behavior.
The next thing that you have is what we are experiencing right now, a completely lawless society where everybody breaks the rules.
The government says alcohol is a causal factor in 60% of road accident deaths in South Africa. Brenda Kaplan, whose son was killed in a drink driving incident, says South Africa must stop ignoring what she calls its drunken driving catastrophe.
Everybody knows that, for instance, in Parkhurst on a Saturday night,
There are hundreds, maybe over 1,000 youngsters getting absolutely wasted at night, and at least half of them are getting into their vehicles. Now,
she says the police should be out in numbers in such areas, not to arrest people and lock them up, but to breathalyze them and prevent those above the legal alcohol limit from driving. Dembowski says there has to be better enforcement of South Africa's seatbelt law.
Studies have suggested that we could reduce our fatalities in South Africa by 30%, instantaneously. 30%, just if everybody wore their seatbelts.
He says very few South Africans, including police officers, wear seatbelts.
They then use the excuse, oh, but what if I have to get out of the vehicle quickly because I'm being shot at? How long does it take to press a button to release your seatbelt?
Dembowski says until South Africa's authorities themselves start obeying traffic laws, there will be no end to the continued slaughter on the roads. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
This is VOA and you're listening to Nightline Africa. Up next, the latest in sports, music from our African collection for your listening pleasure and relaxation. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. In Nightline Africa sports, the African champions Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa have lost 2-0 to Japanese side Kashima Antlers in the quarterfinals of the FIFA Club World Cup in Osaka. Sundowns were making their debut in this tournament, having qualified for Japan after winning the African Champions League for the first time in their history in September. But the South Africans' hopes of progressing were dashed by two second-half goals from Yashushi Endo and Mu Kanazachi. The South Africans will now play South Korea's Deobank Hyundai in the fifth-place playoff match on Wednesday. Kashima, fresh from clinching their eighth J-League crown last weekend, will face Atlantic Nociano of Colombia in the competition's first semi-final on Wednesday. Spanish giants Real Madrid are scheduled to arrive in Japan on Monday, face Club America of Mexico in their semi-final on Thursday. The Club World Cup features international football's six continental champions, plus a team from the host nation. Uganda has lined up five international friendly internationals as part of their preparation for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations, which kicks off on January 14th. The Cranes will begin their warm-up with a game against host Gabon on December 29th before facing Libya on January 1st in Tunis, according to their coach. Uganda, who qualified for the Nations Cup after a 39-year absence, will then take on Tunisia on January 4th, Slovakia on January 8th, and the African champions Ivory Coast in Dubai on January 11th. The Cranes are grouped alongside Egypt, Ghana and Mali for the 2017 Nations Cup and will be based in Port Gentil during the group phase. Uganda is the only country that qualified for Gabon 2017 from the Council for Eastern Central African Football Association CECAFA region, and the Cranes are also still in contention for a place at the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia. Meanwhile, CECAFA has revealed there will be no Senior Challenge Cup or Kagame Cup Championship in 2016. According to CECAFA media officer, Kenya had accepted to host the two events but pulled out for what they called lack of sponsors. Sudan had initially been selected to host the Challenge Cup, while Tanzania was meant to host the Kagame Club Championship, but both countries withdrew. And in athletics, Morocco's Salah Eddin Bonassara has taken his first marathon victory at the Guangzhou Marathon, while Ainalem Kasahun of Ethiopia claimed a convincing victory at the IAAF Bronze Label Road Race on Sunday. The men's race witnessed a thrilling three-man contest in the final kilometer. Bonassara, Kenya's Ezekiel Omulo and Almayahu Balichu of Ethiopia pulled away to pace the race after 37 kilometers. The trio remained almost level for another 4 kilometers until the 26-year-old Bonassara started speed up. It was Banasoa's first triumph in a marathon, having made his debut at the distance earlier this year. Omolo, who just celebrated his 29th birthday on Saturday, trailed Banasoa by 2 seconds to finish a second. The 31-year-old Balechu, who improved personal best, took third place in 2:11.16. In the women's race, former champion and course record holder Mulu Seboka was upset by her compatriot Kasahun, who enjoyed a comfortable lead in the final kilometers and clocked a winning time of 2:31.52. The 26-year-old Seboka was the fastest woman on the entry list, having set a personal best of 2 hours, 21 minutes and 56 seconds last year when finishing 6th in Dubai, but was not at her best on Sunday and managed 2:32.26 to finish as the runner-up. Morocco's 34-year-old Saoud Kambochia rallied to finish a distant third on her marathon debut. Established in 2012, this is the first year that the event has been an IAAF bronze label road race. The roundway course alongside the Pearl River attracted a total of 11,000 runners. And that's it for Nightline Africa Sports. Yes, 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 it's Sunday here on Nightline Africa. And this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent. Here we go.
See this loving way I get, start to go mad. Oh my God, girl, the way you grind. Anytime I see you, I'm blind. The way you handle that. Uku. Me. You go loving me. You go killing me, baby.
Mix Monster, Mix Monster.
Plenty, plenty.
And that was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The happy outcome of the Ghanaian election represents another step in the efforts to make the West African sub-region a more perfect democratic dispensation. Even though there were some fears that problems might arise because both sides were claiming victory, in the end, the defeated candidate, President Mahata, did concede and accepted Mr. Addo as the new president of Ghana. We also saw this in Nigeria, where Goodluck Jonathan did concede defeat. I think this is the way that Africa should go in a democratic election. Of course, there is some sadness that in the Gambia, even though President Yahya Jammeh did concede in the first instance, he has now reversed his decision and is now opposed to the result of the election. He has called for new elections, but this is very unsatisfactory because presidents or candidates should not call for re-election when they have lost. But we'll have to see what may have caused a review or a change of mind by President Yahya Jammeh. I think the signs were there if we had looked deeply. From some very good reporting, we learned that in the first instance, when the head of the Electoral Commission wanted to announce the result of the defeat of the president, he did ask that he should wait until he had conceded. Luckily, he went ahead and announced it, and the crowds came out in the street to welcome the new president. Then in the evening, he did concede. But this commentator had some feeling that perhaps Yahya Jammeh was playing a game that Mao Zedong played just short of a decade when they defeated the forces of Kuomintang in China. He noticed there were some dissensions in the Communist Party, and then he dug deep into Chinese literary history and came out with this presentation. He said, "Let 100 flowers bloom, let 100 schools of thought contend." And this let out a flare of all kinds of discussions and dissensions in China. He then clamped down, and that was the cause of the Cultural Revolution. It may well be that two events that happened after Yahya Jammeh's concession worried him. The first was the release or on bail by the veteran opposition leader. And then, perhaps much more serious for Yahya Jammeh and the military, was the decision to revoke the decision to pull out of the ICC. This could have had implications not only for the president, for the military, given the brutal way they have governed Gambia. So we have to wait and see. I know the UN, the African Union, and others have insisted that Yahya Jammeh should admit defeat. But we know Yahya Jammeh over the years, over 22 years. It is a very serious development, and this matter should be handled very carefully. I thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jonah. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again on Saturday. Have a good weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 months after the official launch, Mexico's Executive Secretariat of the National Public Security System, known as the SES-NSP, marked the completion of the instructor training course for criminal investigation under the new accusatory criminal justice system. A ceremony was held recently at La Muralla Police and Forensics Training Center of the Federal Attorney General's Office. The course strengthens the technical and operational capabilities of law enforcement officers who are responsible for criminal investigations. Implemented through the Merida Initiative, the course was jointly coordinated by the SES-NSP and the Embassy of the United States in Mexico. It is part of a national program aimed at training criminal investigators in the accusatory criminal justice system. Since the start of the course in July of this year, over 600 investigative police from Mexican state prosecutors' offices, the Attorney General's office, and the anti-kidnapping unit have been trained as instructors in criminal investigation. The training includes the core competencies that are fundamental for law enforcement and successful criminal prosecution, including proper procedures for detention or arrest of individuals, criminal analysis, and preservation of a crime scene and evidence. Graduates received a kit donated by the U.S. Embassy containing tools needed to complete a thorough investigation at the scene of a crime, which they will use to train other investigative police throughout Mexico. Speaking during the ceremony on behalf of the Executive Secretary of the SES-NSP, Deputy Executive Secretary Lazaro Gaitan Aguirre recognized U.S. government support for the program, emphasizing the importance of achieving consolidation of the accusatory criminal justice system and continuing efforts for professionalism and specialization of Mexican law enforcement. Kyle Grimes, Senior Consultant for the International Criminal Investigative Training Assistance Program from the U.S. Embassy, underscored the importance of replicating the training for investigative police throughout Mexico to acquire the necessary skills that will enable them to meet their responsibilities under the new criminal justice system. The United States is proud to partner with Mexico to help the brave men and women of law enforcement there better serve the Mexican people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.